Major Hargreaves, Reel 3.
I was saying that in the jail of Buchenwald, my cell door opened one day and a number of people came in, including these two men in long black leather overcoats, which I always associated with the Gestapo. But in fact, they announced themselves as being members of the Swiss Protecting Power. They said that they understood that I was a British officer and that I had been held for some time by the Gestapo, and that they were here to do whatever they could to improve my conditions for me, and if possible, get me moved to a proper prisoner of war camp. Well, for quite a long time, I didn't believe them. I just didn't think that it was at all possible that this sort of thing could have happened. But almost at once, my conditions began to improve. I was given a Red Cross parcel. The commandant had me to dinner in his own quarters. And there was I was given exercise. A uniform was produced for me, or when I say uniform, a battle dress. Warm clothing. Miraculously, everything began to improve almost at once. And then I was eventually moved from Buchenwald and sent to my first proper prisoner of war camp, which was at a place called Marisch Trubau in Czechoslovakia.
Before we go on to that place, could I just ask you why you think this was done for you, or was it done for other people?
I've no idea whatsoever. The name of the Swiss was a man called Denksler. I understand he was a representative of the Red Cross. He didn't tell me how he knew that I was there, or whether they were looking for other British officers. I said, one became so suspicious, you didn't believe half of what you were told at the time. You know, it all became such a shock to me as to be quite unbelievable.
How long were you in Buchenwald altogether then?
Oh, it was only about, I think, for about 4 months altogether.
And how long had it been before the Swiss came to see you?
That was from the time I was there. They came, immediately they came, things began to improve, and very shortly afterwards I was moved.
So the Swiss came to you almost immediately after you arrived at Buchenwald, did they?
No, 4 months later, after I'd been there 4 months.
But what I mean, you were in Buchenwald altogether for 4 months,
yes,
were you?
Yes, yes.
But at what stage during that 4 months did the Swiss first come
to you? After I'd been there for about 4 months, that's when the Swiss came.
So they came right towards the end of your period?
Yes, yes.
During your period at Buchenwald, what type of food were they giving you?
Minimal food. I don't even remember what it was, as a matter of fact. I know there was very, very little of it, usually about one meal per day. By the time I got to a prisoner of war camp, my weight was 7 stone. And as you can see, someone of my size, that makes me pretty thin.
You must be well over 6 foot.
Yes.
Mm. Were you made to work?
No. No, I think to work would have been... I would have liked to have done something, anything, to have had communications with anyone else.
Were you totally without communication with anyone?
Yes. Completely. Mm.
You weren't able to establish the kind of contact which you'd established?
I don't know. This place where I was, which they called the jail, a very funny place at all. I seemed quite a long time to be the only person there. I don't know why I was there. It's one of the great mysteries which I've never ever solved.
How did the guards treat you at Buchenwald?
Oh, usually with indifference, except with this one man who seemed to be the commandant of the unit, this man called Williams. He was pretty rough and brutal. He thought nothing whatsoever about laying about him with his fists.
Did he lay about you?
Yes.
For what reason?
No reason, I can think. Inadequate answers to questions, usually. All the usual Germans shrieking and screaming and Schweinhund and the German people are going to dominate the world. All the sorts of propaganda stuff that they always went in for.
What was the name of the POW camp in Czechoslovakia you were sent to again?
It was Oflag 4C, I think it was. No, that was Kolos, was 4C. I can't remember. But it was at a place called Marisch Trubau.
Can you describe the camp, please?
Yes, very, very large. I must say it seemed like heaven to me to get there and to find that this time it really was a proper prisoner of war camp. I was put into the hospital straight away and Red Cross parcels were produced. Everyone was very, very friendly and kind. It was winter time and very cold. There was very little heating of any sort. The place was overcrowded. The Russians were getting close, and I had only been there for quite a short time when it was decided to move the camp completely.
By a short time, do you mean a matter of weeks?
Yes, I can't remember how long, possibly a month altogether. And suddenly we were told one day that we were to be moved. Everybody was marched off down to the local station goods yard, where the train was drawn up full of cattle trucks. And we were ordered to remove our boots. And there was the most enormous pile of handcuffs and leg iron and things I've ever seen. And we had to get into the cattle trucks were divided by a barbed wire partition. The prisoners were put in what you might say was one third of the cattle truck. We were squashed in, about 40 of us, I think, in there, and the rest of the truck, there was a machine gun mounted, and each one had a German guard. It wasn't terribly uncomfortable. There was room for us to sit down on the floor, but there was not room to spread yourself out with any great comfort. And I think within an hour, certainly, of the train having left, most of us had been able to get out of our handcuffs and the leg irons that had been put on and thrown out the windows, which infuriated the Germans. But there's nothing very much they could do about it. And then we were there, I think, for about 3 days in these cattle trucks. And eventually, where did we go? We got to Brunswick and found that we were put in some barracks which had recently been vacated by the Luftwaffe. And they'd withdrawn in rather a hurry, and they'd left all sorts of things behind them, like radio sets and motorbikes, which were one thing about prisoners of war. They turned into the most accomplished thieves. So anything that could be snatched up was taken and contrived to be hidden somewhere or another. And eventually everybody settled down. And I hadn't been there for very long. And once again, I can't remember how long, when Germans told me I was to be moved. And this was at a time when there had been one or two other escapes from prisoner of war camps where the prisoners had been captured and shot. The SBO at Brunswick told me I was to give my parole, that I wouldn't attempt to escape during the move. They didn't say where I was going, merely to another camp. But the Germans refused to accept it. They said, no, we won't accept it. First of all, we know that you're a terrorist, and also we know that all British officers have had instructions they must escape at all costs at any time. So that was rather worrying. One wondered exactly what might have been behind their thinking. However, we were once again set off with two guards, and I was told of the slightest indication that might lead them to believe that I was attempting to escape, I'd be shot straight away. And I can't really remember how long it took us, but eventually we arrived at Colditz, and I'd never ever heard of Colditz before. I didn't know what it was and never heard about it, and saw this enormous great castle perched up on top of a rock. It looked very romantic. Came up the hill and was taken in. Everyone was very, very suspicious. They looked at me in a very suspicious sort of way, and very unfriendly indeed to begin with. But eventually, after a certain amount of explanation, I was accepted, and I always looked on it as a great privilege to be there. The Germans even at that particular time, they always treated people like myself rather differently. And within the camp at Colditz, they had a group of well-known people, which you know about, whom they call Prominenti. And then they had another group of Prominenti second class, which there were one or two other people like myself who had been in concentration camps or in Gestapo jails, who knew something, or who knew something to the absolute detriment of the German army or the services. And we were also locked up separately. We had extra roll call, we were locked up at night, and that was a bit unnerving too, because one didn't know exactly why they were taking the trouble to do this.
Sorry, how many of you were there in this group of Prominenti second class, as
you
put it?
I can't remember. There was another chap called Ivan Jeffries, who had been with the partisans, and he'd been captured, and he ended up in Colditz. I think there must have been about a dozen of us, but I can't really remember who the others were.
Were you allowed to mix freely with the
others?
Yes,
we were. We during the day we could mix freely, but we had extra roll calls in the morning, during the day, about three extra roll calls a day. And as I say, we were locked in at night, so we couldn't get out and move about or anything like that, or go from one room to another. Well, the rest of Colditz, if anyone wanted to, they could easily go from one room to another.
Were you in a room by yourself or with others?
No, all of us were in the same room. There must have been about a dozen of us, I think.
How comfortable or uncomfortable was it in this room?
Oh, the whole of Colditz was pretty uncomfortable, because by this time the war was well on the way towards... It had reached a stage where transport was getting almost impossible. There were no Red Cross parcels. Food was very, very scarce indeed. There was no heating. And life was very Spartan, and they kept moving more and more prisoners in. A French camp, which had come from the east somewhere or another and walked God knows how many miles, they were brought in. There must have been the best part of 1,000 of them, I think. And of course it overcrowded us tremendously. But by that time, of course, everyone knew the war was well on the way towards being over. The only thing that worried people was whether the Germans were going to make any sort of last-moment action against us. There was an SS unit in the village below. And we were all rather apprehensive as to what might be going to happen. But it all came out all right in the end. I think you know all the story of how at the very last moment we saw American tanks bringing their guns to bear on the castle, and it wasn't until someone waved a Union Jack, which they'd made, or a French flag as well, that finally persuaded them not to open fire on it.
With your particular group in Colditz, was there any of the twitting of the Germans that one hears about from Colditz at large?
Oh yes, everybody went in for that, whatever you could possibly do. And there was great competition to be arrested and to be sent down to the local cells and the jail and the village, because that was the most wonderful thing that could happen to you, practically. Because there you had complete isolation. It was nice and quiet. It was a lot warmer than in the castle. You could take your books down with you. You had nothing whatsoever to do. And in fact, we had a roster of who was to insult the Germans next, so we would get a turn down in the jail.
Did you go into the jail yourself?
Yes.
And was it as good as it was made out?
Oh, it made a very pleasant change. Anything, you see, life as a prisoner of war is so unutterably boring, anything that's a change is really quite enjoyable. And it doesn't matter if the conditions are just as hard, at least there's something else to see. There's always the possibility that you might be able to escape. Although there did come a time when we were all officially told that escaping was over, because there was no point in it. But if you were captured, you were shot. There was no alternative.
Whilst you were in the hands of the Germans, had you had any contact with your family in Britain?
No, none whatsoever. No. You mean when I became a prisoner in Colditz?
Once you got into German hands,
Got to a proper prisoner of war camp, I was given the same privileges as all the other people. One had these funny lettergram things that they used to give you. And I was able to write to my parents, who had been told I was missing, believed, killed. So it was a bit of a relief for them.
I can't remember whether you said whether or not you were getting Red Cross parcels in Colditz.
They were very, very few and far between, and often instead of one parcel per person, it might be one parcel between 10. The food was very short in Colditz indeed. But it brought out a great deal of ingenuity. Some people were extremely clever. We used to form ourselves up into small messes, according to people with similar interests. And all sorts of small devices were constructed for the heating of water. The American, the Canadian parcels were excellent, and they used to produce a tin of dried milk, something called Klim. And these tins could be used for all sorts of things, particularly for making little concentrated burners, stoves for heating water or for cooking over. And they were really most useful.
Are there any particular personalities who stick in your mind from Colditz?
Well, yes, all the obvious ones like Bader, David Sterling, Charlie Upham, Charlie Hopetown, Cecil Merritt. And I made a lot of very good friends there. Mickey Farr, Pat Ferguson, two others.
Can you describe to me the circumstances under which you were released, apart from the flag showing, which you've already described?
Well, as I say, everybody knew more or less that the Americans were within very, very close range of us, and by this time we'd taken over the administration of the castle from the Germans. All we wanted from them was really them to look after us, to make certain that the SS didn't come up. But we had a complete free range within the castle, and we used to clamber outside and get up in the up onto the roof and into the bell towers and the cupolas, where you had a wonderful view. The weather was extremely nice. It was late spring, and then just one day the gates opened and some small American soldier poked his head in, made some sort of ordinary remark, saying, well, we are here, you're free. But we couldn't move out, I think, for 3 or 4 days. The Americans had to collect some transport ready to move us. Some of us moved down into the village for a little bit of home comfort, moving to some houses there, and we commandeered some local transport so we could have a drive around the country. But once again, it was certainly not safe to go very, very far away, because there were still quite a lot of pockets of resistance, particularly some of the young bands of people called werewolves, the very, very young German boys who were still operating quite actively, even just within the town itself.
How did the liberating army seem to be behaving?
One didn't see very much of them, but as far as we could see, there was nothing to complain about. So eventually they produced a lot of trucks, and we had to drive quite a long way to an airfield, which name I don't remember, and from there they flew us back to a place called Westcott in Oxfordshire. Then it was rather infuriating, because they took us, moved us to another camp, which was also surrounded by barbed wire, and that didn't go down at all well. and quite a number of us refused to stay and walked out. I walked straight out and booked myself into the Ritz Hotel, which I thought was a pleasant contrast.
Were you debriefed when you got back to Britain?
Not that I remember, no.
Do you think that your period of imprisonment left any long-term effects with you?
Yes, I think so. Certainly, for quite a long time after the war, it took a tremendous amount of readjustment. I was only in England quite a short time, and then I was flown out to the Pacific. But by the time I arrived there, that war was almost over as well.
In what way did you have to readjust?
Well, I suppose there was personality more than anything else, and there was a lot of very, very unpleasant memories. I found that I was very intolerant, very bad-tempered, very, very hard to live with. I was married in 1945, but it was not a happy marriage, and I think the fault was mostly mine. I just couldn't make the necessary adjustments. And it was very, very difficult. You become unreasonable. You know you're being unreasonable, and you know you're being impossible. But this just seems to be, you can't control it. It's very, very difficult indeed.
Were there long-term physical effects?
Yes, I still suffer from them. One of the things that sort of petty but unpleasant things that happened, during one of my interrogations, all my clothes had been removed, and I was in this particular same office suite I told you about, which was very, very attractive. And this seemed to be the thing that they were always trying to do, to create this tremendous contrast between their own civilization and sophisticated atmosphere and myself, filthy, dirty, bearded, filthy, dirty, and stinking to high heaven, starving, well, pretty well starving in any case, and then chained up to this wall, and to make you feel as though you were beyond any form of human consideration. And during one of the interrogations, one of the Germans was smoking a large cigar, and he thought it was a very amusing thing to come across and stub it out on my penis. And it was not particularly brutal, but it was sickening, and it made me feel ill, and I created like mad. And when I got back to my downstairs to my jail, I said that I'd been very badly treated, I was in pain, and I wanted a doctor. So a doctor was produced, and I had a lot of giggling and everything going on, and laughing like mad. I didn't really expect any particular treatment, but I felt like making a fuss, and I thought that I'd do whatever I could. But this chap merely looked at me and produced a large syringe. He said, "Oh, well," he said, "I've just got the thing for that. I'll give you an injection." But what he did, he put the tip of the syringe into my penis and injected corrosive acid into my bladder. And that's... It was agony, as you can imagine, but at the same time, one couldn't help but almost feeling amused, because they were so absolutely paralytic with laughter themselves. They were absolutely crying with laughter. They thought it was so funny. But this is something that, of course, has affected me for the rest of my life.
What do you feel about the Germans today?
Oh, nothing at all. I mean, you can't carry on. You can't carry a hate. In individuals, certainly, possibly. I remember with great unpleasantness, but German people, I don't mind. I've been stationed there again since the war.
One thing that I'd like to ask you, coming back to the Chetnik period, you were saying about the reluctance of the Chetniks to fight the Germans. Mm. Did you feel it's incumbent on you to try to encourage them to fight?
Yes, very, very much indeed. And always one got promises, usually sort of backed up by saying, "You get us a delivery of arms and we'll fight. We're short on arms. We can't do this. Get us some machine guns. Get us some anti-tank guns. Get us some long-range anti-tank guns. and we'll mount an attack on a proper military target. But of course, one couldn't produce the necessary weapons for them. And I think they knew this pretty well by this time.
What?
Sometimes they would be quite prepared to do small things, perhaps to ambush a train or to ambush a convoy, but nothing very big, nothing that would involve too much loss of German life.
What type of reputation did the partisans have?
Well, they were looked on as much worse than the Germans. Communists, and of course they knew jolly well what was happening. You know, that they were going to be the eventual winners. But the Chetniks would infinitely rather fight partisans than they would Germans, with the greatest enthusiasm.
Could you see any reason why the Allies should change their support from the Chetniks to the partisans?
No, we were utterly uninformed. It was very difficult to understand what was happening altogether. Occasionally one got a news broadcast, but even then that didn't explain things.